We have, it seems, at long last found the point at which the American consumer says, yeah, no, I'm out. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 15th of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You are, I'm sure, sick and tired of me and others telling you that spending by or on behalf of consumers accounts for 70% of this economy. Fine. We'll give it a rest for a while. After today. Because retail sales numbers came out this morning and consumers just ain't. An almost 9% drop in retail sales compared to February. Bad. Very not good. Dig into it a bit, though, as we like to do around here, and it gets worse. Sales of clothing, for instance, and accessories down more than 50%. 50%. That's bad enough if you're a clothing retailer, but as Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports, you've got another problem, a clothing retailer that keeps on snowballing. One word here, inventory.
The spring is one of those big selling opportunities in retail. It's when stores put out the dresses and florals and sandals and can sell them full price because we are all very excited for warmer weather. This spring has been a disaster. It started when the virus hit China and shut down factories. Retailers couldn't get those spring clothes to stores in the U.S. Sonia Lipinski is a managing director at Alex Partners.
So then some of them were able to airship and they're spending extra money eating into their margins to get the product in.
Then the virus and the lockdowns came here, leaving the clothes stranded in stores. And now it's really hard for retailers to get those clothes to the shoppers they still have online. Tiffany Hogan, an analyst at Kantar, says a lot of retailers just don't have the logistics set up.
They don't have the capabilities to pick things from the store, send them back to those warehouses, and then get them back to shoppers in a timely manner and an efficient manner.
At this point, these are the wrong clothes anyway. Remember, stores are currently stocked with pastel cardigans and floral print dresses. Sonia Lipinski again.
Does that really align with, you know, folks who are sitting at home all day and want to be in lounge gear?
Or bright pink leggings and fuzzy slippers, like Lipinski was wearing when we talked. By the time stores reopen, we will be well into summer or maybe even back to school selling season, leaving behind a glut of clothing that retailers already paid for and can't sell. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Word is the Small Business Administration loan program that a whole lot of small businesses were looking to as a lifeline is set to run out of money as soon as this afternoon. $350 billion spoken for in something less than 2 weeks. Marketplace's Justin Ho has been on the Paycheck Protection Program story for us from the beginning. He checked in today with some of the companies he has been following.
The SBA reported this week that the industry sectors with the most approved loans are construction, manufacturing, and technology. Businesses in California, Texas, and Florida are receiving the most money, which makes sense since they're the three most populous states. New York is fourth, but it came in behind Illinois. That worries New York City Small Business Commissioner Greg Bishop.
What I'm hearing from small businesses is either their bank is not participating because they have a smaller community bank, or their bank got online much later than the rest of the United States.
Some businesses aren't sure where their applications are in the process. Ashwin Deshmukh owns a cocktail bar in Manhattan. He says he thinks he's been approved. His bank accepted all his paperwork, but he hasn't gotten any confirmation.
I think it's impossible to tell if anything's happened until you have the money in your account.
Similar story for Washington, D.C. marketing consultant Alexandra Mason. She applied back when the program started.
I sent in my application and they acknowledged that they have it, and then I haven't heard a thing for a week.
Mason says until she sees the loan in her business account, she'll remain skeptical about the SBA program. And she says she's not the only small business owner to feel that way.
I'm never going to poo-poo, you know, a million businesses, I believe, getting approved. But you don't have to go very far. I mean, just look at Twitter, and it's just scrolls of people saying, well, this isn't what I'm experiencing.
Those small business owners are hoping that their loans get approved as soon as possible. The Wall Street Journal reported today that the SBA program is about to run out of money. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Wednesday, lousy retail sales, not great corporate earnings. Oil closed under $20 a barrel. So what's your guess? I mean, honestly, could go either way, right? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Thank you. What I'm about to say here isn't rocket science, but it does bear repeating out loud. When this economy finally gets going again, it ain't going to be all at once. It's going to be start and stop, and it's going to be regional, too. So right now, a look at one region in this economy, upstate South Carolina, home, as we have reported a couple of times over the past 3 or 4 years on this program, to the biggest BMW plant in the world. A plant now shut down, but in better days, a keystone of what is now a diversified industrial economy in and around Spartanburg. David Britt sits on the Spartanburg County Council, where he chairs the Economic Development Committee. We have talked to him a whole bunch of times about the manufacturing economy down there. Mr. Britt, good to talk to you again.
Same here, Kai. Nice to talk to you under these difficult circumstances.
Very, very difficult and frankly still quite strange after a month's circumstances. It occurred to me as I was thinking about our chat that I have never in all the years we have been talking asked you what you do for a living. And it seems kind of appropriate now to check in with you professionally as opposed to in your official government capacity. What do you do and how's your work going?
I'm vice president and general manager of Tyndall Corporation, our South Carolina division. Tyndall's headquartered here in Spartanburg. And really, this is how I got into my governmental role. I got recruited by a number of business leaders to run for council to recruit companies here. So it all kind of ties together. But what we manufacture is precast product from data centers, airport facilities, distribution facilities. We're considered an essential, you know, service. Yeah. And when it comes to our manufacturing team, they're here and I need to be here with them. It's kind of like a general with his force.
Yeah, I get that. Okay, so to your official capacity now, we have talked a zillion times, you and me, about that BMW plant. But I think what I want to do today is have a conversation about Spartanburg and all the derivative companies and how that area is managing at a time when the biggest employer, BMW, is not making cars. What are you doing down there?
Well, you know, we expected what would happen with BMW because, you know, you take BMW, Michelin, Volvo, Boeing, they all call, you know, South Carolina home. And those are the large manufacturers that have their supply chain all over the world. The good news about Spartanburg, and I think for the most part, South Carolina, we only have about 35% of our workforce that are tied to the automotive industry. Hmm. So we're well diversified. So 65% of our companies here in Spartanburg have been operating. It has changed things. I mean, we've all adapted and are doing things to kind of support the fight against this virus by making things like gowns, you know, hospital gowns, masks, you name it, we've been doing it.
How's the mood in your neighborhood?
Well, I mean, I think it's a confused mood. I think a lot of folks were very frightened and scared in the beginning, and it's kind of like a war. When you can't see the enemy, you don't know how to protect yourself, and I think there have been a lot of confusing messages, you know, that are out there. What we've tried to do with our team, and I think, you know, several of the other companies here, we've tried to rally our team. And so, number one, you got to have trust in the leadership and our partners out in the organizations. We trust them to work safely, make a product that we're keeping America moving, and just trust each other and not be afraid.
Last thing, and then I'll let you go, Mr. Britt. We have heard elsewhere in the program this week about reopening this economy and how that might shake out. You're a guy with his finger on the pulse of a key manufacturing part of this economy. What's your sense of how this goes once people start feeling okay again?
Well, I think it's going to be a challenge because, number one, we were woefully unprepared as a county, as a state, and as a nation to go into this pandemic. For industry to come back in full force or even halfway, we need reliable tests, and that's a huge problem. Manufacturing, we need masks, we need gloves, but most importantly, we need tests. That's where people will get that confidence. I think people are just scared right now because this is a deadly virus. But the good news is if we get our act together, we see the sunshine through these dark clouds.
David Britt, longtime interlocutor with me on this program. He's a county councilman. He's the chair of the Economic Development Committee down in Spartanburg, South Carolina. Mr. Britt, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Cass. Stay safe and healthy.
You too. It's Tomorrow's pretty much the biggest day on this week's economic calendar. We'll get a number for first-time claims for unemployment benefits at 8:30 East Coast time. And remember, this is the indicator that's been giving us the best insight into how bad this recession is going to be. 17 million Americans have lost their jobs in just the past couple of weeks. Best guesses are tomorrow's number is going to add another 5 million or so to that. State unemployment websites and phone lines are, of course, jammed as all those people try to get benefits, including, by the way, an extra $600 a week from the federal government. But as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, a lot of people who aren't working because of the pandemic still can't get unemployment.
Meet Carol Norman.
I live in White House, Tennessee, and I am 77 years old.
That's just outside Nashville, where Norman has worked as a seamstress, making $15.50 an hour sewing uniforms. Now, her factory is considered essential, so even though the city of Nashville ordered most businesses to close, it didn't. But that worried her family. Colby Woodis is her grandson.
We were all trying to put some pressure on her to stay home. You know, she's from that generation that is very committed to work, and she's the hardest working person I know.
They finally convinced her to ask for a leave of absence. Her company paid part of her salary for the first 2 weeks, but she isn't sure that'll continue.
They say that I'm not eligible for unemployment because they are not shut down. I'm not actually laid off. I just took a personal leave.
Under the new federal pandemic unemployment program, you aren't eligible if you quit or take a leave to protect your own or a family member's health unless you have a COVID-19 diagnosis or a doctor's note. Gig workers and the self-employed are also supposed to be eligible. But Martin DeHaan isn't sure he is. He's finishing his senior year at Florida State University from home. He used to tutor physics 20 hours a week at $30 an hour. Then school went online and...
all of my tutoring sessions have canceled. And as a student working privately, I find it very difficult to file for unemployment because I don't have an employer.
Then there's the case of 52-year-old Brian Forrester of Tulsa, Oklahoma. He almost gave up on finishing his online unemployment application when he saw the warning that misstating facts could lead to a substantial penalty.
I know under the old system, you know, before COVID system, that I didn't qualify.
That's because his last job was doing seasonal deliveries for UPS, and he left that job voluntarily. Then he got a job offered to be a field worker for the U.S. Census, which he accepted, only that's now been put on hold.
And so I'm kind of out of a job. I can work. I want to work. And I have a job technically, but not technically because we haven't officially started yet.
Forrester doesn't know if he's been approved for unemployment benefits or not. He's just heard that the census won't start until at least June. He says it's all very worrisome. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It came out much more gooey, and I tried to make it into a baguette, and it came out looking like a rocket ship.
Just because it's trendy doesn't mean it's easy, you know. But first, let's do the numbers. Ah, the Wawa's. Dow Industrial's off 445 points today, 1.8%, 23,504. The NASDAQ off 122 on the point scale, 1.4%, finished at 8,393. The S&P 500 shed 62 points, 2.2% there, 27.83. JCPenney tumbled more than 27% after Reuters reported it was considering filing for bankruptcy. Of course, coronavirus. Financial stocks softened on sharp falls in first quarter profits. Bank of America down 6.4%. Today, Citigroup off 5.6%. Goldman Sachs beat it, though, a 10% on the upside. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Late spring is probably the most important time of year on the college admissions calendar. Acceptance letters have gone out, financial aid packages and scholarships awarded. And high school seniors are deciding where or if they are going to go to school next year. But the changed financial reality for so many that the coronavirus has brought and uncertainty about what school is even going to look like this fall means the calculations both seniors and their families and the colleges hoping to enroll them are making have gotten a whole lot more complicated. Elizabeth Heaton is a college admissions consultant. Elizabeth, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So let's look at the students and their families, first of all. Do these decisions, do you see kids deciding to go to different places based on what's happening in this economy because of this crisis?
Yeah, I definitely, we're already seeing that. So we're already seeing families where maybe the student is living in California, gets into a school on the East Coast. Everyone was on board with the student going there. It was the top choice. And now that school is located in an epicenter of the coronavirus crisis. And simultaneously, the family's financial picture has changed. And so now that local, very good public school is a much better choice.
This crisis, I think, will probably lay more bare some of the realities that became clear last year in the admissions scandal, right? The idea of privilege in this process, the idea of access. And that goes all the way to things like not just admissions, but even like college visits and being able to get there. I mean, my guess would be there ain't no colleges doing tours right now, right?
Yeah, pretty much. They've all shut their campuses down for the most part. And even if they haven't, I think most people are saying, well, we're not going to risk going on to a college campus right now. So what has been interesting to me is to see the colleges who have been best able to pivot and put resources towards engaging with families in different ways. And that might benefit those kids who couldn't afford to go to campus anyway. But they still need to understand that they may have to reach out. And, you know, if you haven't been raised to think that that's something you can do, or this is all new to you and your family is new to the college process, you may not even realize that that's an option available to you.
Right. And these crazy times make it even more difficult to figure out your way through this Byzantine process. Let me ask you the question, frankly, that is being asked about everything in this economy right now. Because we just don't know what's going to happen. And that is, how do you suppose this crisis will change higher education? Do you think it will?
I don't see how it can't. You know, one big thing, it seems sort of the arms race, right? Who can have, there's a school with a lazy river. There are all the joke always has been, well, look at our great climbing walls. And I wonder as colleges move forward from this, what of those kind of extra things go away? What do they look at a model that combines online learning with being on a campus and allows the colleges to deliver something that's a little bit more economical? Do families start to say, hey, we saw this work pretty well? Maybe that's more interesting. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to imagine how they could come out of this and not look at things differently. But, you know, obviously that really remains to be seen.
Beth Heaton. She's at Bright Horizons College Coach. She's a college admissions consultant there. Beth, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Kai.
As bad as things are for businesses in this economy right now, and they are, spare a thought, would you, for firms over in the UK. The years and years and years of Brexit, first of all, then the threat for those that export to the United States of being tariffed by the Trump White House. Bad as all that was, though, it is small potatoes compared to what the coronavirus has done. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has been revisiting some small businesses he's been in touch with to see how they are coping with this latest crisis.
That's the Tom Fort Saint-Antoine. So semi-soft cheese from eastern France.
As a cheese retailer, Dominic Coit is classed as a key worker and so is free to ply his wares. But his staff of 15 just didn't feel safe mingling with the public.
I wanted us to carry on as much as we could, but the decision was to take in to furlough all the staff, and that was what the staff wanted. 100% said that we want to be furloughed.
They've been temporarily laid off, with the government paying 80% of their wages. Meanwhile, Dominic struggles on, manning a small stall in a Saturday market, selling some cheese online and generating a tiny trickle of revenue.
That's nowhere near enough. It's only about 10% of our retail income.
He feels battered. Brexit was bad enough. That led to a fall in the value of the pound, removing a big chunk of profit on his imported French cheeses.
It seems like we have crisis after crisis in the last sort of 4 or 5 years with Brexit and now the coronavirus. It seems like it's a lot of effort just to survive.
Bolstered by a large government-backed bank loan, he reckons his company can survive, so long as business is back to normal by the fall. More than 100 miles north of London, this company, Clevedon Fasteners, is also struggling. Before the virus struck, this was the sound of the factory making more than 1 million rivets a day. Now it's shuttered. Managing Director Steve Hardiman.
We thought we'd see if we could ride out the storm.
But his subcontractors, heat treaters, platers and toolmakers, shut down and he was forced to do the same.
We couldn't really continue any further because what we were making, we couldn't get finished.
His 15 office staff are now working on full pay from home, processing the small number of orders they're still getting. He's furloughed his 25 factory workers and is topping up their 80% wage support payment from the government.
Because it's very unfair that people in manufacturing who can't work from home are only getting 80% of their income, where all the office staff are getting 100%.
But this can't go on for long. Hardiman reckons if the lockdown stretches beyond the summer, his company will be finished, and it won't be the only one. UK Inc., or UK PLC as the Brits put it, is already in deep trouble.
If this isn't sorted and people are back to work within 3 months, it won't only be Clevedon, it will be UK PLC that goes bust.
The damage is already unprecedented in modern times. According to one survey, some 20% of all British companies have already furloughed their entire staff or are intending to do so. 9 million Brits, more than a quarter of the workforce, could be out of work. The Cabinet meets this Thursday to review the lockdown. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Toilet paper, for some weird reason. Pasta, also for a much more straightforward reason. Rice, as well. Another section of the supermarket where the shelves have been bare? Flour and yeast. Demand is way up in these coronavirus times, as Marketplace's Kristen Schwab reports.
The recipe has a picture of a fluffy loaf of bread fresh out of the oven, golden brown with beautiful cracks in the crust. It's easy. It's fun. It's delicious.
It came out much more gooey, and I tried to make it into a baguette, and it came out looking like a rocket ship.
Antonius Julia Jaya in New York has attempted the recipe 5 times with mixed results. And why not? He's got all the time in the world. He actually ordered a baking kit from a local bakery for $50 because he couldn't find flour or yeast at the store. Red Star Yeast, one of the country's major producers, says demand right now is unprecedented. And at King Arthur Flour, sales are 3 times higher than usual, even for whole wheat flour.
Typically at this time of year, we're kind of operating at 50% capacity.
Karen Kohlberg is a co-CEO.
And in the past 3 weeks, we have turned those on to full tilt and they're operating 24/7.
Kohlberg says we aren't running out of wheat. Much like toilet paper, shelves are empty because of logistics. But why has baking bread become an obsession? Amy Bentley, a professor of food studies at NYU, says actual bread shortage in some places is one reason. And let's be real, carbs are comforting.
There's the kneading the dough with your hands. There's the distinct way that the yeast smells. And then I'm not sure there's any better smell than the aroma of baking bread.
Also, bread is cross-cultural. Sourdough, naan, or challah, it all makes us feel more connected to family. So it turns out, during a pandemic, the best thing since sliced bread is any bread. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which I am going to tee up by straight up ripping off a tweet this morning from one of our Friday regulars, Gina Smilek at the New York Times. This is, she tweeted, the most depressing beige book of all time. Regular listeners will know I kind of love the beige book, the Federal Reserve's 8 times a year anecdotal look at this economy broken down by Fed region. Usually there is lots of good and often quirky insights in there. Not so much today. Here's the beginning and end of the lead paragraph. Economic activity contracted sharply and abruptly across all regions in the United States. All districts reported highly uncertain outlooks, with most expecting conditions to worsen in the next several months. I mean, we kind of all knew this, right? But it's just different somehow. when the Fed says it. And we are out of here. The Dow Industrial's down 445 today, 1.8%. The NASDAQ down 122, 1.4%. The S&P 500 gave back 62 points. That is 2.2% on that particular index. Our media production team includes Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. I will say this every Wednesday for as long as we're doing this. They're the ones going into work so the rest of us can stay home. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.